Founded in 1991 by patients, the FSHD Society is the largest grassroots network of FSHD patients, their families, and research activists. The FSHD Society offers a community of support, news, and information for the millions of people affected by FSHD worldwide. This is FSHD Society Radio. Welcome, one and all, to the FSHD Society Radio Show. Thanks for being here as I clunk around through our new way to get through to you through YouTube. It's always fun when you're going through directions and you're already live. And we were live. So thank you, Lee Reynolds, for sending me the text message. Looking great. You're live. So welcome all to the FSHD Society Radio Show. And we're learning the lesson, if you can't laugh at yourself, then, you know, you're maybe taking things too seriously. So thanks for being here and spending some time with us on another episode of the FSHD Society Radio Show. If you want to get in contact with the show, I will be in the process of trying to open up the chat room through YouTube. That's one way for sure. Right now, I just have a great view of myself and my guest, Carlos Romero, who is in studio. Well, he's in his studio, and he's going to be our guest tonight. Also, we quickly talk about last month's episode, and if you missed that, that was with Sue Drescher, and talking about all the great things she's doing within the FSHD Society. So if you missed that episode or any other past episodes, you can find it all, well, pretty much anywhere you can find podcasts. You can find it, I think they're on YouTube now, and Spotify, and a host of other platforms. So just go ahead and use your favorite podcast player and search FSHD Society. And please share, like the shows, get the word out. We're really trying to spread the message with this show, because we have, if I had a drum roll button, I would probably hit that. Maybe Carlos has one. And we have a brand new sponsor, our first sponsor of the show, which is PerkinElmer Genomics. And that is the FSHD Society podcast radio show sponsor. And we'll have a plug for them and talk more about them later after our featured guest tonight. But I don't want to have people wait too much longer, because there's a lot to cover here with Carlos as he is hanging out with us tonight. He's our featured guest, and we welcome him aboard on today's show. Welcome, Carlos. Thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. This is such a pleasure. I'm such a fan of the FSHD Society and your work as well. After you invited me, I definitely started tuning in and listening to. And as somebody that also creates content on the internet, I got to say, I'm nervous because you're so much more professional than me.
Professional, man. I don't know. I mean, I think I've just fallen on my face more often maybe with this stuff, you know, or I call it the gremlins, you know, get in my studio area, little corner of my basement where I do this stuff, or things go really smooth. I didn't know it, like today, and we're on and don't know it. That's okay. It's a casual place, Carlos, and you're a good friend here to the society to be on the show with us, and just so glad to have you. So glad to have you here, because there's so many things that, you know, I want to talk to you about, because you have so many talents to share, and so many stories within those talents. So, but why don't we start with the FSHD story for you, maybe the diagnosis story, kind of maybe that's maybe a good place to start. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's kind of where everybody's journey starts.
Yeah.
So I think I was, I'm 37 now, and I was officially told that I had FSH, like they had figured out what it was around the time that I was 27 or 28, but became symptomatic, the early signs, when I was just about 18, probably. Mm. And I definitely, looking back on it now with hindsight and like an education and understanding FSH better, it's obviously easier to understand, oh, these early warning signs were very obvious. But not obvious at the time, obviously. So, yeah, I was like 18, 19 when I started to notice that there was something going on with my shoulders. I think, you know, it's kind of very typical for most people that FSH, I would say. Mm-hmm. And, started to notice, I think the first earliest memory I have is I was, hanging ductwork overhead, And I remember you just holding the ductwork up, and it's not something that's particularly heavy. And the coworker that I was working with at the time was like in the rafters above me and trying to hang it. And I just couldn't quite hold it properly. And he started teasing me, and I just, I didn't think of anything of it, you know?
Right, right.
Yeah. And then that progressed. And I definitely had a feeling by the time I was in like my early 20s or mid 20s that like, oh, something's wrong. And personally, this might sound weird, but my attitude was like, I don't want to know what this is, because I've had a strong feeling in my gut that I was like, this is going to be a can of worms. Whatever this is, I don't want to open this can of worms. But by the time I was like 26 or 27, there was so much pain, like the, you know, in my shoulders that I couldn't sit properly, or I had to lay down just to like alleviate this pain. And so finally I went to a doctor, and, you know, of course they sent me to a neurologist, and then immediately he saw both my shoulders and goes, I think you have something called FSH. And I was like, I don't know what that is. And he was like, well, it's muscular dystrophy. And I was like, I don't know what that is. And, you know, I think like everybody who gets diagnosed, I'll remember that day forever, and, you know, being in the doctor's office and all that stuff. And just not understanding, you know. And I said, well, what is muscular dystrophy? And he said, well, it means someday you're going to need a walker. What was it? A cane, a walker, and a wheelchair, is what he said. And didn't explain exactly like this is what muscular dystrophy is, or this is what's happening to you, but just told me your scapular are winged. And I said, like, what is muscular dystrophy? And he said, you're going to need a cane, a walker, or a wheelchair. And I was like, what? Like, I'm here because my shoulders hurt. What are you talking about? You know? And I'm sure that, you know, we've all got a story. Yeah.
Well, that's kind of why that's kind of why I'm chuckling. I'm not doing it to be mean, but yeah. Right. I mean, you walk in thinking one thing. I mean, I had like a rotator cuff thing. That's what I thought. I'm like, it's just because I was throwing a baseball all summer with practice because I'm a baseball coach. And then I go to throw a football to my kids in the yard. It's heavier or whatever. And I'm like, oh, ooh, wow, that arm really, really hurts. Whoa, something's up. You know, four doctors later, I'm being told you have a form of muscular dystrophy. I was like, what? I almost slapped the guy. I'm like, oh, no, I don't. Man. So, yeah, I mean, I totally get it, you know, that you think one thing and then you're like, maybe I don't even want to know what this is. And, okay, so I can't reach that great. So you talked about that work part where you kind of noticed something was up. I mean, did you notice anything even earlier or even younger than that, if you can look back now?
I don't think so. And it would be too hard to pull apart from having like a problem with my weight, like at that age. I've always been a heavy set dude. And, around the time that I was diagnosed, by then I was over 400 pounds.
Wow.
And when I was 18, 19, 20, it's probably about 300 something. Okay. And, you know, so much of it seemed like it could have been intertwined with my weight. Like I started to have back pain, right? As the beginning of lordosis set in. And I know that now that maybe it was the beginning of lordosis. Maybe it is the beginning of like FSH affecting those muscles. But at the time, I just remember walking and being like, my lower back's killing me. And for me, I really only at the time didn't know anything about muscular dystrophy and was just thinking like, I need to get my weight under control. So it was really, really hard for me to pull apart. Like, is this, even looking now, is this muscular dystrophy or was I just struggling as a big guy? So I think the earliest memory I can point to probably was when I was about 17 or 18 and I was like trying to lift ductwork overhead, or there was another time where I was trying to push an air handler up to somebody overhead and it didn't go well and he dropped it. And I have a scar that's like right here to this day. Didn't get too hurt or anything, but I remember just feeling like it felt like a normal amount of heavy. Like, I don't know how else to say it. Like, this just feels heavy to me. But I remember my coworker being like, dude, what's wrong with you? Like, come on, like push it up here. And I was like, I am, you know?
Right.
And I think those were the first times where I could remember, you know, I really can't do something that other people are starting to see or say that I should be able to handle.
Yeah, it's like a tricky thing because you're almost like second guessing yourself through it. You know, like, wait, is this or is this that? And then a part of you maybe thinks, well, it doesn't matter because this sucks. So it's like there's yeah, it's like, totally. like who can I blame for this pain right here? You mentioned, the weight. You were 400 pounds, you said, right around before you were 18, 19, because then it looks like you lost some weight and then went to 300 and so. But it's been a journey for you for that. And that's something I definitely wanted to touch on because FSHD has been something that you're dealing with, of course. But the fact that you've overcome weight loss and, I mean, that takes a massive amount of dedication in my mind. So, and to see you now through Zoom, how much are you at now? What is your weight at this point?
About 250. And I'm not quite sure like where my normal weight it is. I actually need to go get like an actual full DEXA scan to help understand how much of this might be loose skin, how much of it is going to be like actual remaining fat, and how much of it is a missing muscle. Obviously like we all are. And I want to understand like what is the actual percentage of body fat that I should have, and therefore try to calculate like where's my actual healthy body weight, because I still don't know. When I was a rock climber, like I was super lean. For me, that was like 215 pounds for me was very, very lean. People were starting to tell me, they're like, I think you've lost too much weight, dude, be careful. But to me, I was so motivated and like to perform well that I just continued to try to lose anyway. So, but now it seems to kind of stabilize around 250, and it's still like an ongoing thing that you have to manage. It's, for my opinion, is that if you're somebody that really struggles with like obesity or morbid obesity, or like you have a serious problem, it's probably not something that you win a fight one day and it's over. It's something that has to be managed. It's something, you know, cause there's nothing more I love than sitting around with a bag of chips and salsa and watching TV. Like, I mean, I'm still the same guy like that I was. I still want pizza. I just don't have it.
Right. No. Oh man. Yeah. You're right. That's like those casual times, like a day where you can just do that and it's like a treat, but I can understand that that's not something that you want to fall down back into the rabbit hole, so to speak. Right. That's like that, cool. that is a tough road to walk. The rock climbing, was that part of the, I don't like to use the word diet. Honestly, it was a good friend of mine who, lost a lot of weight as well. And he said, it's not a diet. It's really a lifestyle change. And I honestly started correcting myself with everybody else that I'd speak about those kind of things with. Like, so how did you tackle the lifestyle change? You know, not the diet, because diet feels temporary, right? So was rock climbing part of that lifestyle change for you? Is that part of your motivation?
Not exactly. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a answer to me. Well, let's just talk about like how somebody could approach losing weight. I think like if you're out there and people, I get this question a lot, like I want to lose a bunch of weight or I'm struggling. What do I do? Here's the number one thing I don't like about this misconception when it comes to weight loss or changing your life. It's not something that happens overnight, and you're exactly right that it's a lifestyle. And what is a lifestyle actually built of? It's built of several habits. And, you know, you see somebody who's struggling with their weight. I've had this like kind of a coaching-esque conversation with people that come to me when they find out like that I've lost this weight, and they're like, I want to do that too. And so this is the conversation I have with them, is you have several bad habits right now, and it took you a long time to create these habits. So you have to understand it's going to take you a long time to break them and to create healthy ones. Mm. And to me, the first step was documenting everything I was eating. Get an app on your phone. MyFitnessPal is what I've used for the entire thing. If you want, I've got the whole graph on there. I'm not sponsored by them. That's just the one I use. And start writing down what you eat, and understand that most humans, an average number is about 2,200 calories a day, keeps you alive and maintains your weight. Obviously that's a little bit dependent on your gender, height, and all that other stuff, but that's the average that I could give you. Most people don't understand that, you know, they go to McDonald's and they eat like more than 1,200 or 1,500 calories. And therefore you have to understand, technically I've eaten more than half of the total amount of energy I'm supposed to eat today. Mm-hmm. And understand like that was just my lunch. What did I have for breakfast? What did I snack on in between?
Yeah.
And what am I doing for dinner? And what am I doing after dinner when I want something sweet late at night? That's way more than you need. So I think it's about building good habits. And for me, the very first one was write it down and get used to writing it down until it's like a repetition. You know, now I look at anything, you hold a slice of pizza, I can accurately tell you how many calories are in it within 100 calories. Wow. Because I understand the calories that are in flour and dough, and because I wrote it down for so long. Mm-hmm. And then eventually you'll get to a place, you should always write it down if you're struggling, but you may get to a place where you just have a stronger understanding of what you're doing to yourself and what you're eating. Mm-hmm. And then after that, once that becomes a habit and you're starting to eat within where you should be, and it's no longer a struggle for you to choose the right thing or to say no to the, you know, when you need to, then start taking a look at, okay, do I feel like I'm up for walking a little bit? And don't go out there. This is, I think I'm giving you a really long-winded answer. I'm sorry, but
no, the good stuff.
I guess if I had to put it into a short answer, is you need to correct these habits one thing at a time. And the number one mistake I think that people do when they lose a weight loss battle is saying, I'm going to the gym 5 times a week. I'm changing it all right now. Blah, 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 blah. And you commit yourself to a completely different lifestyle that is not sustainable if you're not conditioned to it. So really what I'm trying to tell people is, like, get conditioned to these new habits and do it one at a time. And when you're ready for the next step, don't go 5-10 steps at once. Just start walking. Okay, I got to make sure I'm going to walk 20 minutes 3 times a week. I'm not going to go out there and power walk. I'm not going to kill myself. I'm just going to go walk. And then eventually you'll naturally get to the point where you're like, I'm going to try to add some more time. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm ready to sweat a little bit. You're going to get conditioned to walking. And this is what I did. I did that with my mom. She was a key part in helping me lose the first 100. She dragged me out walking. And every time, I totally give her that credit. Mm-hmm. But then after that, of course, it grew into, you know, what else can I do? And then when you get bringing into the diagnosis and taking a look at, well, what am I going to do with this whole situation? You know, that's where we kind of get into, like, where para-athletics come in. So, I'm sorry, that's probably way more information than you wanted, but I think I could sum it up with, like, one habit at a time.
Yeah.
And don't dive into something that is brutal, like, because you will start to establish a negative relationship with your exercise and with the gym. You're going to start to feel like someone is dragging you there. You're like, and you don't want that feeling. You want to be either excited or okay.
Yeah. Okay.
with going back to the gym, you know?
So how about the people that, okay, I'm going to say this real. How about me? Because I sometimes want to get a little, you know, lose some weight, right? I'm at such and such mark. I want to lose XYZ amount. But I start doing first of all, I'm definitely a victim of the person that you were talking about, where I want to do this, I'm going to change this and this and that. And then I start trying to do maybe some drastic changes or some drastic workout thing, and then my body's killing me. I'm like, oh my gosh, that was stupid. Now I stop, which is probably the worst thing I can do, doing this up and down and this and that. So I love that advice. So if we follow that and start slowly making those changes, writing down your food calorie intake, I think that's awesome and easy. I mean, it's on everything you eat, for God's sake. It's not that hard to find. And then, of course, you're doing exercise at a nice pace. But let's say people are going along that road for a while, and then they get a little bit, frustrated. Like, I'm not seeing any change. You know, how do they push through that and then just keep going? Is it just back to staying consistent? I mean, how do you trust the process when you don't feel like it's doing anything?
Well, I think if I were to give you, like, a technical answer to that, you know, what should I really do to address that immediately? I think it would be, well, okay, understand what your basal metabolic rate is, which that number means how many calories do I burn per day if I were to lay in bed and not move at all, just my body keeping me alive.
Okay.
Most people average number is about 2,100-2,200 a day. And then start understanding, like I said, create a caloric deficit and understand how much I'm eating, and then try to create maybe like a manageable number of deficits. So if you calculate your BMR, and you can hop on Google and just type in BMR calculator and put in your gender, your height, your current weight and your age, and you'll get a pretty accurate number generally. And then create a deficit, meaning eat less than that number.
Okay.
So if you get the number of 2,200 calories a day, try eating 2,000 a day and then see what happens over, let's say, 2 weeks. And that can be frustrating because you may not see results, but if you don't gain any more, you should take that as a victory. when you're trying to get these things under control. And then go, okay, I've tried 2000. Let me drop it down to 1800. Let me see how that goes and give it 2 weeks. My other piece of advice is don't get on a scale every single day, because your weight, I don't know if people are just listening to this, I can't demonstrate without using my finger, but when you lose weight, it looks like this on the graph. It doesn't look like a straight line of I'm doing everything exactly correct. So every day I'll see a half a pound of loss. That's not how your body really works. And also, your body does get conditioned to using less calories. If you consistently eat less, it becomes more efficient at creating energy with that small amount of food, not small amount, but lesser amount of food than you were probably eating.
Yeah.
And so that's the tricky thing about it as well, is you might get stuck because your body is saying, oh, you've been giving me 2000 calories a day instead of my 2200. I'm going to become really, really efficient at using this to stay alive and to keep you at your current activity level. And so that's when introducing the correct amount for wherever you're at as a disabled person or a not disabled person, the correct amount of exercise that works for you. And I would say that I would create a small calorie deficit, see how it goes, and then make sure that's a good habit, that you're used to eating that, and then maybe introduce some light walking or whatever exercise you enjoy, if there's something else, as long as you're getting your heart beating. And then lower your deficit number if you need to from there. I would not encourage people to go create a gigantic deficit. I'd say like aim for 10% and start there. And also realize that if you want to win this battle in terms of getting down the scale down to a certain number, it's a long journey. Mm-hmm. Just like it was a long journey for you to become over the weight that you want to be. You didn't get there overnight. It's going to take you some time to get out of it. Which is why I don't like any kind of like weight loss TV shows. Mm. The thing I hate the most is when they ask people like to bust out of the picture of themselves.
Yeah.
Of, you know, their big version down to this, because it really sends to me a subliminal message of like, I did it instantly. And it's like, no, you know, when I did Good Morning America, I was like, you didn't see 3 years.
Right.
Like, you just asked me to do this because it looks good on camera.
Oh,
And we could talk about that later if you'd like, but I'd say start small, make sure it's manageable, and understand that you're committing to changing something that's very, very big in your life. And then it's pervasive and it's a part of everyday life, no matter what. You know, if you're struggling with other types of addictions, not to say which one is harder, but you can just say, I'm going to stop doing that. I'm going to stop drinking a couple beers a night, and you can stop. You don't need to drink beer to stay alive. You need it to feel nice.
Correct.
Sometimes.
Yes.
But like, you don't need it, but you have to eat. You have to interact with this thing every day. And so it's really about changing that relationship and understanding what I'm eating.
Wow. That's awesome. That's great advice. It really is. And I'm glad that we touched on it, because I know that there's a lot of people that struggle with it, especially with FSHD, because you're thinking to yourself, I can't hardcore work out and go nutso with weightlifting and super cardio. Right. I can't even run. You know, how am I supposed to lose weight? And I think it's a really practical way of attacking it and going after it, and yet feeling healthy and motivated through it. So that's good. So you alluded to it before, you know, and so did I, about your climbing career. Talk a little bit about that.
That was a really amazing thing that changed my life. And not just from the perspective of the weight loss and all that stuff, because to me, they diagnosed me and it was a decision of, okay, I see two ways out from here. I'm either this is going to kill me, like, or I'm going to do something about it. And so when I started looking up people that, you know, had done really amazing things, so emotional, sorry.
No.
When I started looking up things that, you know, people that had done amazing things, you know, I found people like Ryan Levinson, who is incredible and, was there for me when I was between this point of like, I've lost this weight and I don't know what to do, but I knew I wanted to be a disabled athlete. And I found Ryan through, actually, I think the FS Society's Facebook group, you know, I said, I've told people like I'm working out and doing this. I'm training a lot, like 10, 12 hours a week. But I want to find something to do. And, I can't quite remember how I got connected with him, but you know, somebody probably accomplished para athlete. Ryan has, I think there's like a few medals to my name. And for everyone I have, Ryan has 10, like, and, in different sports, it's absolutely insane.
Yeah.
Like in surfing, in, I think cycling, yeah, I think he was a triathlete. And of course he's a really inspirational guy to talk to. Also had a really real conversation with me. And he said, you know, I told him like, I wanted to share the story and what I was doing. And he said, well, right now you're training like an athlete. You're just spending time in the gym and you're going to need to find a way to express this. Mm. Like you're going to need to find something like a discipline to apply yourself to. And I talked to him about weightlifting and I taught, and you know, ultimately I think he had persuaded me out of that particular activity because he was, you know, cause the, that was just me, like certain types of lifting that I was interested in trying. He was like, you might want to be careful, dude. You might want to think about something else that's engaging to you, that seems challenging and that you'll be passionate about. Mm-hmm. And, there was a rock climbing gym right next to the apartment that I was living in time in Bellevue, which is a suburb of Seattle.
Okay.
And, I wanted to pick something, this sounds weird, but I wanted to pick something as a sport that we should not be able to do, like that people with FSH should not be able to do, that you would think like you have no business doing that if you have FSH.
Right.
And so it actually was archery first. I tried archery and I did enjoy it actually, but it didn't capture me. Mm-hmm. And to be real honest, it takes a lot of focus and peace of mind, and I'm not that guy. Like I'm wiggly and I'm like fidgety, and you know, I just was like, I need something else.
Yeah.
And so I was driving by the rock climbing gym one day and I was like, I can't even reach past my shoulders. Like I have no business doing that. I'm gonna try it. And that's so awesome. I like scheduled the first time. Yeah. And like when with like a, like they have like staff that you can hire to do the first climb, because when you go climbing, you have to have someone else on the side of the rope keeping you safe. You don't just go up a wall. I don't know if people realize that.
No. Yeah. Right.
But you're attached to another human and there's gear and everything. And the first time I went, I didn't get hooked. I went and was scared out of my mind. I've always been scared of heights. I never got over it. I just learned to manage it and it didn't capture me actually the first time. I just was like, man, that's, that was so nerve wracking. And I didn't even make it the whole way. You know, I was climbing 5.5 and 5.5 there's a grading system in rock climbing. And as you go higher in the decimal count, it gets challenging. So 5.5, 5.7, 5.6 and 5.5 to give you an idea is basically like climbing a ladder. That's the holds and everything are close enough that it's essentially like climbing a ladder. And so I only climbed half of 5.5 and was so scared and freaking out and out of shape. Even after all the weight loss, it still wasn't conditioned to that activity. I observed it, how I felt it. And I called him back and I called some friends and was like, hey, I just tried this thing. I want to try it one more time, but I want to try it with my friends instead of the gym staff, you know. Mm-hmm. But you have to learn how to belay, which means you have to learn how to manage the rope from the other end. You're watching your climbing partner climb.
Okay.
And it's your job to work the rope and keep it in your gear to make sure that if they fall, that you catch them. Like it's very, very simple.
Yeah.
And the first time that I was belaying for somebody else and I said, you know, I realized that I was some small part of their success. I was like, they're up there in a fight basically right now, challenging themselves. And it's my job to keep them safe and make sure that they're enabled to do what they want to do up there. And that's when it actually hooked me. I don't know why, like I'm a supportive type of dude, despite the fact that I make horrendously filthy jokes on stage. Like I'm a pretty compassionate person. And that was the thing that captured me. And so then went through the belaying process and learned how to do that. And then started inviting my friends. And then when they kind of got into it, and I dragged them, to be fair, when I dragged them to the gym and they got into it and I got to be some small part of their success, then it really hooked me. And I was like, this is awesome. Like, I want to do this some more. And then once you start to get comfortable with, like I said, I never got over the fear of heights, but once I got comfortable enough to manage that fear and to start looking at it and getting, you know, you're really only in competition with yourself when you're climbing. And it, I got fully engaged and I got hooked on it. It's a long ramble, but I'm going all the way back to what Ryan said, was you have to find something to express yourself in a way that you're passionate about. Like, and I viewed the whole thing as a way of telling a story to people that hopefully would inspire them. And I'm not saying that everyone should go try rock climbing. I'm saying the point of it was really that I had made a decision to do something challenging, and that, you know, the multiple doctors were like, you shouldn't do that. Right. And I was like, fair enough, but I'm going to do it anyway, you know? And I think the moral, I guess, or what I try to tell people is like, try to define what you're currently capable of yourself. And that's for any human, mm-hmm. not FSH or not, but I think that it's really important that you find something you're passionate about and something that you can share and pursue it. And I think that's ultimately what right. the climbing was about. And it led to so many opportunities. And it also, as I got into the competitive side of it, that was really life-changing as well. And then getting into competition and realizing and finding some kind of success also taught me about what success actually took, and like taught me about the value of failure, which sounds weird to say, but you know, when it comes to rock climbing, when you're trying to break into a new grade, let's say that you're climbing 5.7 and you're like, oh, I want to climb my first 5.8. It takes a long time. You're climbing 5.7 and then you start doing double. You do double routes is what I did. I was like, I'm not just going to go up once. I'm going to go up twice. And so I'm just going to try to get in better shape. Then I'm going to try to go to 5.8. Mm. But how many times you fall off the route is something that people never saw. Like even when I got into competitive stuff, like they didn't see the 99.999% of it. That is just, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how to do this. I'm going to try to do everything that I think makes sense to get me closer to the next climbing, the next grade. And that lesson of success and what it takes to get there to me is the most valuable thing I've ever learned in my life.
Wow.
So yeah, I'm sorry. I'm going on and on, but yeah,
that's
how I got into it.
You were very successful at it too. Winning nationals and awards for it, you know, talk about that a little bit. You know, we're not talking to a man that, well, I kind of just climbed in that gym a little bit and had some fun and messed around. I mean, you took it to a competitive level.
Yeah. Yeah. That was something that I stumbled over. My goals were not aligned with competition. I didn't know about that thing. Got into it, like I said, because I was like, I want to do something that I have no business doing to see if I can. And, you know, if I fail at it, that's okay. I'll still share that story. But, you know, I started to post videos and stuff just to share with people, again, kind of listening to Ryan's advice on, you know, share this, go do something and share it with people. And that's all I was doing. And my initial goals were, I wanted to be healthy and I wanted to be able to share the story and help people with it. And as I started sharing this thing, people started contacting me about a number of different things. And one little comment on Reddit, like, creates opportunity. It was one guy who like stopped into a post I had created for a second and just said, hey, are you going to be at nationals next year? And that was it. That was the first time that I had found out that there was any form of competitive climbing for disabled or able-bodied people. I just, you know, I envisioned originally, I want to climb something on board, but here, you know, that story of like, I don't film and share that book, that would be so cool. Especially like visually. But he left a competitive angle of rocking. And of course, there is a competitive angle for people with disabilities. And it's called paraclimbing, which when I tell people I used to be a paraclimber, they're like, was this parachuting? Was this?
Yeah, right.
Everything else
has that idea.
But it's called It was terrifying. It was terrifying because I've been the fat guy on the couch my whole life. So to say this, I'm not athletic. I've been climbing for years, years and years of all different forms of this, a wide spectrum of physical impairments. And I don't know anyone there. But I think it was the more that I dedicated myself to this thing, it just a little bit more. The more empty. If we have nothing else in common, you don't get at that without being disciplined and motivating yourself. I was like that. That energy I wanted to be able to, I think it was, and this was within bouldering and the bouldering rock climbing is that bouldering.
Oh, we might have lost them. Okay. I know the YouTube guys are in a little bit of delay, but with some internet issues, looks like we lost them for a second here. Hopefully, we'll get Carlos back on. His maybe the internet connection was kind of bouncing around a little bit. So, those that are watching on YouTube, we kind of lost Carlos, but hopefully he'll log back in. He's got the link, and we'll get him back in here hopefully. Just kind of lost him. So, it's been fun talking with him so far because the things that he's tackled and the things that he's overcome has been pretty amazing. You know, losing the weight. Dealing with the FSHD diagnosis on top of that happened when he was dealing with 400 pounds of weight issues. So to lose that, overcome that, and then go into the weight loss side of it and just knock that out was just awesome. Which is awesome. Hope he comes back in. Yeah. It's thanks. Thanks, Reynolds family. Yeah. he's very inspirational. And the thing that I noticed that he was talking about was, you know, with Ryan Livingston, and that's Ryan's been on this show a couple times. He was on as a solo guest, and he was on for the telethon event, right? Yeah. A radiothon, however we were calling it this last year. We did that pre-recorded interview with him. It was awesome. It was awesome. The other thing I really was going to hopefully we could talk about with Carlos was the. He did something called Climbing for Noah, and he inspired a young man during the middle of this, and that was kind of where I was going to go with the questioning. So we're gonna see how he's if he can come back in. We'll see how that goes. In the meanwhile, why don't we just I think this might be a good opportunity to play our sponsorship clip real quick. Take a little break, a little breather even for myself, and hopefully we can give Carlos a little bit of time to jump back on. Listening to the FSHD Society Radio Show. Today's podcast is sponsored by PerkinElmer Genomics, a market leader in biochemical and genomic testing solutions. PerkinElmer Genomics understands that obtaining a confirmed genetic diagnosis for FSHD can be difficult and frustrating experience for both patients and their families. That's why their laboratory prides itself on launching new and innovative technologies to help families find answers that they are looking for. Just over a year ago, PerkinElmer Genomics introduced the first new diagnostic approach to FSHD type 1 genetic testing in nearly three decades. This testing has drastically decreased the time to diagnose while increasing accessibility to patients. Knowing the underlying cause of FSHD can have important implications for the entire family, including help with future medical management decisions. Speak with your provider today and learn more about how you can get testing. Visit PerkinElmerGenomics.com to find out more about available testing options for FSHD and other related neuromuscular disorders, that may help you and your family today. That's PERKINELMER genomics.com. Welcome back, FSHD Society Radio Show. That's a little bit of that's our sponsor, our first sponsor for the show. I'm so excited. I hear there might be more to come, but I don't want to spoil that because this is PerkinElmer's time. Once again, visit them at PerkinElmerGenomics.com. Learn more about their genetic testing. I don't know about you guys. When I had my genetic testing, it costed a lot of money. And I think I'm actually still paying on it. And it was just a pain. They were great people. I'm sorry. I'm also browsing some of the comments here on the YouTube thread. So thank you, Nancy Payton. He says he's working on his internet issues. Okay, good. We'll give him some time. Of course. This is how we deal with live stuff. I mean, if anybody's ever watched all these episodes once we went to visual, and heck, even if you were here back when we used the Blog Talk Radio format. I mean, that's like Stone Age, right? June's listening to this. She's laughing right now. I can hear her. And we always, you know, we always would come across, not always, but time to time, you'd have some glitches. Things happen. It's okay, right? So hopefully Carlos will come back on. That link should still be, I know he has it. I can see if he's emailing me too and check on, you know, things, but I'm hoping he's handling it well and the stress of it. I know it can be stressful and irritating. And he's, you know, and this is something else. And like I said, we get him back in. We're not on a huge time crunch, right? There's no producer on the other side. Oh, wait, Lee Reynolds is out there. She might tell me, you gotta cut it. No. I wanted to talk to him about his podcast too. I don't know if you guys got a look at his setup. He's got the great backdrop going on. He has proper mic setup. He's got, I don't know. It's just like, dude, when I had him on before we hit record, you know, before we started going, I was like, man, this is kind of cool. No disrespect to our other guests, but man, it was like, hey, you're a podcaster. Oh, you know, this is cool. He's got the mic, the whole setup. We started talking shop a little bit. I almost lost track of time. Like, oh, we got to go live. So I want you to check this out when the show is over, please. It's Crappy Comics. You can find it on Spotify. It's good stuff. It's, oh man. I mean, I listened to the episodes he has up right now, and it's funny. Okay. It, of course it should be. It's not like the title says that they're all crappy. So you go to Crappy Comics. I'm looking it up right now just to kind of get myself all situated. February 18th, he had his last episode, at least that I see, posted on Spotify. And he had Laura Lyons on, and I listened to that one. It was hilarious. Hilarious. I don't know if you picked up on some of his humor, but he is a funny guy. He is definitely a funny guy. Lean Rail says, but you need some twinkling lights, I think. Those rock. Yeah, maybe I do need. You know, maybe I do. I don't know. What do you guys think? I was thinking like an on-air light somewhere. I don't want to replace my terrible towel, but I have some fun FSHD memorabilia back here too. Like, the Fish for FSHD. I don't want to lose that. Got our, you know, little plug for our sign, some inspirational things that I love and attach myself to, some personal elements in here. And of course my awesome picture right here. It's good stuff. Yeah. So yeah, maybe I could get some twinkly lights, maybe like right down the seam of the room. You know, this is like the corner of it behind me. I think that'd be great. Maybe that's what we'll do. Good suggestion, Lee. Like a good producer that you are. She said, I'll never cut you off, she said, by the way. that's funny. Oh, wait, we got him. Here he comes.
Aha.
Boom. Carlos, right on cue, man. He came back right on cue.
I have no idea. No idea. Of course, my internet never gives me problems. Then I was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to be on the show.
Of course.
Then
I call those gremlins.
Yeah, you know? So I was rambling. You want me to just take off where I was?
Absolutely, because I kind of hinted, you know, the directions I was going to go, but I didn't want to take too much away because I knew you're going to come back on. I'm like, this guy's not going to stop. I know he's coming back. So yeah, we were talking about your competitive side of your climbing and how you didn't even know Nationals existed. And then you attacked that and you got into it. I think that's kind of roughly where we left off.
Yeah. Yeah. The first, please stop me if I'm just rambling too long, man. But I think the first competition was in Boulder, Colorado.
Okay.
And it was a really small group, and it was specifically for bouldering. And ironic that it was in a place called Boulder. But the difference between rock climbing and bouldering is you usually climb between 10 to 15 feet off the ground. But it's a very, very challenging problem to climb. It's very, very aggressive.
Okay.
It's about kind of like, you know, it's like sprinting versus cross country.
Gotcha.
Right?
Okay.
And bouldering is not my thing because, you don't wear protective gear. Like you free fall to the ground if you're bouldering. It's not ever been my thing. I do rock climbing, but, I tried to minimize risk as much as I could. So I always did rock climbing, which is there's a rope, top rope above me. I'm pretty safe. I'm wearing gear. But I won silver at that competition. Really the value of it to me was just doing it, like regardless of how it went. And then the next year is when there was rock climbing nationals. So I think that was 2014. I trained a lot for it. Like I learned a lot about, what to expect from the bouldering nationals. Mm-hmm. And then I went to nationals in, I believe it was Atlanta. I can't remember. I think it was Atlanta. And it was Atlanta. Yeah. And, I went on to, the funny thing is I didn't think it was going to go well. I remember, my family was there, and as we were getting out of the car, you know, I flew in from Seattle. They drove over from North Carolina. And so, you know, we were all in the car together. And as we were getting out of the car about to walk in, I'd already registered online or whatever for the competition. I remember telling them, like, I'm going to set your expectation, guys. Like, you should expect that I'm going to come in last. Like, I was so sure that I was just going to be the dude that embarrassed himself and had no business climbing against these people.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember my aunt saying, just go in there and do your personal best and don't worry about what anyone else is doing. Mm. I don't want to get super any more long-winded than I already am, but, the toughest part was really just getting into my groove, like in the competition. And so I just went back to what I knew, which was, I was like, okay, I'm going to climb my warm-up routes. These first routes aren't going to be like the hardest routes I can climb. And, in competition, it's basically like you get a certain number of points for, certain routes, and we're divided by our disabilities into different categories. And, there are categories they had set by color. So it was like blue was for amputees. They're specifically designed for people that are upper extremity, like I'm missing an arm, upper extremity amputee. And then there were routes specifically designed for neurological and physical disability, which was my category.
Hmm. That's fascinating.
And so, my then girlfriend was there and she did a lot of climbing with me, and, you know, she was really great because she helped me just say, like, just breathe, man. Like, let's walk around and let's eye these routes just like we do when we're in the gym practicing, and, you know, do the easy ones first and then identify which ones you're going to do after that, which ones you think are doable but challenging. And then, you know, is there one that you feel is going to be very, very challenging? And let's try to save that for last. And so I just tried to turn it into like a standard gym rock climbing session. That was it. I remember the first route, it was 5.5. It was something that by then I was climbing 5.8 or 5.9. And, it was like it was something that was very easy, but I remember trying to climb it since it was the first one in competition. Like I could barely climb just cause I was so nervous. There was kind of this very weird ending to the story that people find counterintuitive if you're not tired of hearing me talk about it. But so
they come down every breath here. I mean, I want to know. So keep going. Keep going.
All right. Yeah. So they, there's a timer that I can't remember if it was an hour and a half or not.
Okay.
It was something like an hour and a half to just, you get to climb whatever you can. There's a bunch of people there that were ready to belay you, ready to put you on a rope and keep you safe. You would just walk up and tie in and do your thing.
Okay.
I've never actually told this story before, but, it had come down to like the last 7 or 8 minutes of the competition, and, rock climbing is really tiring, especially if you're tired, if you're trying to climb it, like you're very, as hard as you can, basically at the very edge of your skill and your ability at that point in time, you get tired on one route. Like, the average rock climbing session for me was doing between 5 to 7 routes, and then I would be absolutely cooked. So that would be about 40 to 50 foot routes. So we're talking like 300 feet worth of climbing.
Wow.
And you know that like once I get past route 4 or 5, like my fourth or fifth run, my arms are going to be cooked. Like I'm not at my best anymore.
Yeah.
So there's strategic decisions as to like, where am I going to spend my energy? Am I going to spend it on this one route that I think is worth a bunch of points and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, I had been struggling with this one route in a corner with an overhang. And so there's like 3 minutes left in the competition. And I went up to the judge and I said, what happens if you run out of time, but you're still on the wall?
Yeah.
Like, does that route count? And he was like, no, you get to finish the route.
Oh.
And so I was like, okay. And so I went up to the corner and I climbed up a few pegs and then just stood in the corner and like rested so that I was in the middle of the route when the timer ran out.
Smart. Like, smart.
But you only get credit for the route if you finish it clean. You don't get credit for for climbing halfway.
Okay.
You have to go to the very top hold. You have to get both hands on the top, like for it to be a clean climb to count.
Okay.
And so this was a route that I had tried 2 or 3 times and had fallen off and couldn't finish. And I decided to spend the last of my energy on this one at the end of the timer. Mm-hmm. And so I got up, chalked up, and was like kind of trying to rest on those pegs, and then tried to finish the route. And by then I was the last guy on the wall and the whole gym was like watching.
Really?
Which did not help.
It didn't. Okay.
Yeah. You would think that it's like a movie,
man,
or
this is like a movie. Yeah.
Yeah. You would think that that's exactly it. That you're like, you're going to be motivated because like, you know, that wasn't my experience. To me, it was like, oh God, now everyone's watching me climb. You know, I don't want to do poorly. And so spoiler alert, I didn't make it. Like I was on the wall. I got to the crux of the climb, which is the overhanging section.
Yeah.
And, I remember trying to make a big move with my left arm, and FSH is FSH. And I grabbed the hold, but didn't get a secure enough grip. And I fell.
Yeah.
Which was a bummer. And so I was convinced that I was like this, that was probably it. I needed those points to get this. And you got to wait for a while. I was talking to my family and I had definitely like consigned to like, well, you know what? I got to try to be proud of myself for being here.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
which was for me a big deal. I went up to, you know, they had said that the names were posted, and this I'll remember forever as well. And so it's like, I find my category and there's like a list of names in my name. I've never told this, like my name's on the top of that list. And I was like, what does this mean? And she was like, well, that's the person who won. and I go, yeah, but that's me. as in like you made a mistake. Like I was like, yeah, but that's me. Like that can't be right. And she was like, are you Carlos? And I was like, yes. And she was like, that's the person that won.
That's hilarious.
And
you had so much doubt in there. Yeah. I mean, you had so much like, I'm just glad I'm here, this and that. And you're like, okay, so my name's on the top. So is that alphabetical or like,
yeah, totally.
like what is that? You're like, no, that's the guy that won. Like, well, that's me. That's hilarious to me. That's hilarious to me, because it's like, even in the moment of that, you still couldn't believe it. You still couldn't believe
No, I still couldn't. And it was a really, really insane moment. And, I'll remember that forever. But the underlying thing that I like to share with people is that it's not, I get emotional when I try to talk about this, but it's not a story of success. It's actually a story of being unafraid to fail.
Right.
It's a story of failure. And then the one time it works, and that's, right. That's really all you need sometimes.
Right.
So yeah, that's that story. And then
that's gotta be, a book. I mean, and then it turns into a movie, Carlos. I mean, are you seeing this? You just wrote the script. You just did, because the way you talked about the ending, I mean, I don't know if anybody's listening to this part of it, but like, if you put your, if you sit yourselves down in a movie theater and you're watching this man overcome a diagnosis, a weight loss that to some people would be insurmountable, then says, I'm going to climb it because it's the hardest thing I can pick, and then does it, right? And then the movie plays on. The struggle, you can see it. You can see the montages, right? You working at it. You even have a love interest at the time. Oh, my God, man, this is a movie. And then you get to the Nationals. And this is the movie part of it that is real, right? That, okay, you climb. You're not sure if you win. You don't finish that part. So the audience is thinking, oh, nice try, buddy. This is an inspirational story, not to quit, and you got there. Only then, at the end of the movie, there's Carlos's name on the top.
Yeah.
Boom. Fade to black. Roll the credits. Everyone's cheering. Popcorn's flying. It's a movie.
I like the popcorn's flying in this fantasy.
I think it's it. I think it's it. I mean, at the very least, an amazing book. And I'm an audiobook guy, so I can hear you telling your audiobook story. And I think it's, I just think it's remarkable. So sorry to interrupt and like paint this like picture like that, but that's how I visualized the whole story. It was awesome.
Yeah, it was really, really a life-changing experience. Because like I said, it wasn't just, how I'd, winning a rock climbing competition. Mm-hmm. It was really understanding like, this is what success looks like, and walking away from the entire experience of like going, from the weight loss to the climbing to competition, and saying like, this is what it takes to succeed at anything that is hard.
Yeah.
Is that you have to get comfortable being uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Like you have to understand that nobody knows what they're doing. Like if somebody's doing something more, that you look at with like wide starry eyed eyes, maybe it's an actor or a painter or a musician or a rock climber or somebody who's losing weight or whatever, they don't know what they're doing. Yeah. And it's really important that you understand that if you want to achieve something, you just decide that you're going to do it. And then you make a decision and you evaluate the cost as it goes along and say like, am I willing to pay this cost? And for me, it was, am I willing to risk my well-being to share the story? And the answer to me was yes. And so I did. And I mean, that's really all it is. So, there's a saying by, Miyamoto Musashi, I think that is, once you know the way broadly, you will see it in all things. So meaning for me, I've interpreted that as once I experienced success and it was fleeting, very, very fleeting, I see it in every other part of my life now. And I try to teach people that is if you really want to be successful at anything, then it's about getting comfortable being uncomfortable. And accepting that it's okay that I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just going to do something that I love.
Wow.
And doing it.
Now, you inspired a young man as well, though. Tell us, before I kind of venture into the last part of this, is the climbing for Noah.
Oh man, I will become a big blubbering mess right on your show. So I'll do my best.
Okay.
So it was like maybe a year after Nationals. It was between the 2014 and 2015 Nationals, and between going to Worlds, World Championship. No, it was after Worlds, which I didn't expect to go to at all. I had no plans for that. But after that experience, this lady reached out to me, mm-hmm. and And oh, dude, I'm going to break down right on your show. This is going to get so messy.
Yeah, but as an interviewer, I'm kind of like Oprah that way. I'm like,
you're like, yeah, do it.
Break down, man. I know. I know. Come on.
Let's see some tears.
Yeah, no. I know. No, I know. No, so I know it's tough. It's real stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. This really, really lovely lady had called me and had asked, all she asked me for was an autograph for her grandson. Oh, dude. And his name is Noah. And at the time he was like 3.
Wow. Okay.
And I don't know why Noah has like caused me to have such a powerful connection. Mm-hmm. Dude, I'm not doing it. I'm not gonna do it, Oprah. but Noah really just to me became, you know, FSH is such a huge problem.
Yeah.
There's so many of us. I'm not doing it. Not doing it, Tim. There's so many of us that it's too big of a problem to really comprehend. Mm-hmm. So for me, I don't worry about doing anything for all of us. I just worry about Noah.
Right.
You know, now he's whatever the math is. He was 3 or 4 at the time. And
I'm counting on my fingers for you. Let's see.
Yeah, I think he's 8 or 9 or something.
Yeah, that'd be about right. Right. Yep.
Yeah. And
probably about 9 years old. Okay.
So
he was inspired. I mean, he was inspired at that point because of what you were doing, right? I mean,
well, I think, and this is the part that kills me when I talk about it, is that, his grandma just wanted to have somebody that he could look up to. I'm not doing it, Oprah. All right. We're almost through it. And to me, that was more valuable.
Yeah, absolutely.
Than like any medal I'd ever earned. So, yeah, he's, you know, I think about him a lot. And he's still like the inspiration I draw from, like in everything that I do. So. You know, the climbing days are over. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's just part of it. But you know, I still think about it like every day.
Right. I mean, how can you not? I mean, this young person, I mean, this is a pain to deal with at 45 years old that I'm at, and I had digested at 40, you know, but I already had a lot of crappy experiences to kind of draw from to go, okay, you know, here's another one. And a 9-year-old, or at that time, 3 years old, I mean, really? They barely scratched the surface, and they already have this fight ahead of them. It just isn't fair. It just isn't. So the fact that you could be an inspiration to someone like that is phenomenal. It really is, because that's really what it's about. And the way you put it there with, you know, the trophies and stuff aren't what it's about. It's about the Noahs. It's about the kids, the young people that have to tackle this and kind of need some inspiration. But even like beyond age, you know, there are some people that are recently diagnosed right now, right? And they need the inspiration. And that is still what you are, even to them at whatever their age is, if it's not 9, if it's 30 or whatever, and that people can do what they want to do. And go ahead and find that thing that is so, like, everyone tells you impossible and crazy. I'm going to do it anyway. Screw you, FSHD. You know, in my house, Carlos, me and my wife treat FSHD like it's like a really bad roommate.
I like that.
And it's just like, if I can't reach it or I didn't paint the wall really great, you know, because I refused to get help. My wife's like, that stupid FSHD painted the wall crappy. Look at that. It got on the ceiling. I go, can you believe that guy? You know, so it just becomes this thing, you know, and that's how we deal with it. And everybody has to deal with it. But I really appreciate you sharing that part of it. And I know, and I knew it would be tough because, you know, there's kids that I inspire through doing my coaching for baseball. And there's a young man that was actually on this show because he did a massive fundraiser event at his school for us. And I was like, what? It just blew my mind. I coach this kid in baseball, and he took it upon himself to do this fundraising event for his school on my behalf, but for the FSHD Society. It just blew my mind. So I was just like you, you know, I'm like teary, and I just lost it. I just couldn't believe that I affected that person like that. It's like, wow.
Yeah, it's
wow. Just amazing.
It's really powerful. And, you know, you know, there's more to that story, but I just don't want to, I don't want to like break down on this podcast, on this show, but
we might have to have a separate episode. We'll call it like after the after show or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I need to write it and have someone else read it because to me, it's just like getting it out. It's just like, it's just, it, you know, it's tough, but it's also the most motivating thing.
Yeah.
And it's the way that I also communicate it to people in my life, you know. Yeah. You know, I've moved on to advocating in other ways, mm-hmm. and they're just as challenging as climbing was. I think they're actually more challenging.
Really?
You know, when I tell my partner, like, you know, what I'm struggling with, or I'm like, I don't know if I should do this or whatever. When I wake up, I just go like, well, you know, no one needs to have a future. Mm-hmm. And it's that simple.
Yeah. Right.
But yeah, that was a life-changing part of the whole thing.
So segue into really what you're doing now a lot, and that's, you alluded to it before, being a comedian, now you make jokes that are not family friendly, you know, so we can't really ask you to, hey, rattle off some of your great jokes, but maybe just talk about the context of your podcast and being a comedian now.
Yes, that's so that came along when, you know, I realized I don't think that I'll be able to climb anymore. Yeah. And what am I going to do? Mm-hmm. Because I still have this, to me, agitating voice in my head that's like, you got to do something. Like, I want to be a part of the solution, some small part of it. And, you know, a lot of my climbing and doing the stuff that I'd done was about really about advocating and inspiring people, I guess. And I still wanted to do that.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, what can I do that's just more, I don't know, public facing or more about talking to people? Hmm. And I've always loved stand up comedy. You know, I'm that dude that if we have any conversation, I can quote you a bit from whatever guy from, you know, as far back as I can remember. And I've always loved stand-up, and I was like, and I've always been the class clown that can't keep his mouth shut as well. I'm totally that guy as well. And I was like, well, I should try doing stand-up because it is literally an open platform to talk about whatever you want. Mm-hmm. And if you can get good at it, which is, that's such a simplification, but yeah. If I can get good at it, then I could educate people about muscular dystrophy without them knowing that they've learned something about muscular dystrophy. Most people don't know that it exists. Or Tim, you tell me if you're tired about telling people about their muscular dystrophy and hearing about their uncle's multiple sclerosis.
Oh my gosh.
How my often gosh. Do you hear that?
Like all the time. I'm right. like, no, well, that's MS. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah. Oh, I'm like, yeah. Yeah.
Yes. All the FSHers yes. watching this are like, yeah, oh my God, I thought it was
yeah,
just
yeah.
me.
They're like, oh my gosh. Yeah. That's totally right on. Oh yeah, 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 I've gotten that. Or I've gotten the, just recently, it was through a Facebook group and they were talking about a certain, it was a Facebook group for baseball players, young baseball players. And this guy was talking about how this kid was having a hard time with his scapula. And he actually showed a picture of the boy's back, like, oh, we're trying to activate his scapula. And I like freaked out. I was like, wait a minute. I'm like, he could have something like this. I'm like, I'm not saying he does, but just maybe walk down that road a couple steps and just see. The guy went off on me. I mean, he was like Mr. Negative Town. I was like, whoa. Yeah. I had to block him and stuff. So I mean, you get those reactions too. It's like, whoa. Like, people don't want to hear about it. They don't know about it or they confuse it. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I thought, like, you know, can I find a way that is just more directly a way of advocating, even more directly, you know, than doing the rock climbing stuff?
Yeah.
And if, when you look at really good, in my opinion, my favorite comics, like, when you look at really good stand up, it's usually that person is talking about pain and suffering. And I realize, like, there's no reason that we can't talk about being disabled. And of course, like, as I get into it, I find that I'm not the only one. I actually found that I am the third, as far as I know, the third person with muscular dystrophy to try doing stand up.
Oh,
the other one that I know of that I would say, was an inspiration to me was Allie Bruner, who has congenital muscular dystrophy, okay, different than FSH, but has aggressive congenital muscular dystrophy and has written really good jokes. You can look her up on YouTube. And she's great. But so I figured, I was like, okay, it's an open platform, you know. And if you think about going back to, like, the suffering example, everyone knows Dave Chappelle.
Oh yeah.
Go back and watch Dave Chappelle's standups, and just mute it when he gets to the punchline and listen to his sets. Yeah. And all you really hear is him saying the truth about what it's like to be a Black American.
Right.
And how challenging that is. But he makes, you know, a teaspoon of sugar, you know, makes the medicine go down.
Right.
And that's what he was doing. And not at all to compare myself to that level of talent at all, because I'm...
Oh, but the delivery, like, nobody is what you're going for.
But, yeah. Yeah, I was like, you could talk about things that are uncomfortable as long as you find a way to make it palatable to people. And so, you know, that was the core idea. I wanted to write jokes about muscular dystrophy. And it took me probably almost a year of, like, learning about doing stand-up and writing and going through the process and trying to understand, like, I'm trying to say all these things and I'm passionate about advocating for all these things, but they don't work in a joke. You know, they don't work on stage.
Right.
And I was really battling with it, because the difference between climbing and doing stand-up is, like, if I fall off a route, the only person that sees me fail is the person that, you know, is belaying me, or the people that are gym there it is. If I go on a stage and bomb and like I talk about this stuff, it's going to be horrific.
Yeah, like, it's going to hurt,
you know,
right?
and it does. And it did.
Yeah, okay.
And, but there's that nagging feeling of, like, you know, what is the stupid thing that I can do for this kid? And I stuck with it until I started writing stuff, and then finally got to the point where I was like, okay, I'm going to set the muscular dystrophy part of this aside for a second and just focus on coming up with 5 minutes for open mic. Just like 5 minutes. Can I do this at all? And then I did. And I started to get good at it. And then I started to introduce the stuff about being disabled. It's challenging because it's a topic where I have to be careful that whatever I write is about me and not about all disabled people. Because even if you look at FSH, just it's a spectrum in and of itself, right? Like, it is,
right?
We're all affected so differently. I mean, there's similarities, but, you know, I'm 37 and I'm still walking, and I'm lucky for that. And if I write a joke that implies that I am speaking for all of us, then it's easy for me to obviously offend somebody. So once I had figured out a specific angle, and I just blurted something out on stage one time.
Yeah.
This is the first time I had said publicly, like, because to me personally, people don't realize I'm disabled until they spend enough time or they see me doing certain things. If you just see me walking around, you wouldn't know.
Right. Right.
But so that was terrifying. Like, when I was like, I'm going to say this on stage, was really, really tough. And so the first time I did it, I had 2.5 minutes of material that was not at all related to muscular dystrophy or being disabled, very self-deprecating stuff that I still love and still perform. And then I ran out of, I had 30 seconds left in the set. I know that they're about to turn on my light, you know, to tell me that my stage time is up.
Yeah.
And I just was like, I'm just going to say something about this. And so I did. And, here, actually, I can say this is a clean joke. Okay. I can tell you this. This is, but it maybe not as funny, you know, without all the rest of the context of the set, you know. But I had said, you know, I have muscular dystrophy, which means I'm disabled, you know, and that's you know, that's really challenging, but you guys don't understand that because I like to call you cannies. And then the audience was like, what does that mean? And I was like, it means you can do whatever you want. And they're like, and they started laughing, and that's when I found the angle finally of okay, I'm not gonna make jokes about what I can't do, because it makes people sad, and that's not funny.
Right.
I can make fun of you for what you can do though, and that implies what I can't.
Right.
And that's the angle that I still take this from. So there, what was that? I'm trying to think if there was anything else that I could say on this show that would be okay.
You're trying to self-edit quickly.
But oh yeah, there was another time where I was bombing, and I was doing material about being disabled, and it wasn't going well. And there's no other way to find out if it's going to work other than to just go make an ass out of yourself. That's how it is. And so as I was bombing, you know, there's this incredibly. This is what bombing feels like to me. If you can remember back to when you were maybe 12, 13, maybe younger, you had a crush on a girl, or you're in middle school or high school, and you just did something so embarrassing and dumb that to this day, it still floats into your head. And you go like, oh my God. And you have to like process this shit. I don't know about you, but I have memories like that. And that's what bombing feels like, but that feeling doesn't go away for like several days. Oh, you go like, oh my God, why did I say all those things? That's what it felt. So I was bombing in the middle of this set, and I just started talking out loud instead of doing my prepared material. And everyone's like awkwardly staring at me because it's not going well. And I just kind of made an effort to look them in the eyes. And I was like, listen, guys, this isn't going well. but I got to tell you, you know, I was really afraid of bombing, but now that I'm up here and you're all just staring at me, I could tell you it's not that bad. Like, it's bad, but it's not as bad as being disabled. Like, and like people like erupted.
Oh my God.
And I was like, like, well, that's really the path. Either like so far, that's all I figured out is I either need to make fun of you for what you can do, which implies what I can't. Or you just have to find a way to be open about it, but make sure that you're not telling a sad story up there.
Yeah. So they don't take it so seriously in a way, because you are telling jokes. I mean, that's the context of it. You're making light of it to some degree to get a laugh, but yet it's letting them be aware. It's sneaky.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're taking comedy and you're cloaking an advocacy message in it.
Yeah, which is... You know, when I first started doing that, I think I definitely overcomplicated it. And this is a mistake that every young, and by young, I mean inexperienced comic, which I still am a very inexperienced comic. That's why my show is called Crappy Comics. but they say that the inexperienced comic will do too much setup, meaning you're over explaining at the beginning and you're not getting to your punchline or getting to the funny part of your thought. And so I struggled with that for a long time. And eventually I realized like, okay, I'm never going to be able to write a joke where I can explain FSH and then hit a punchline. Like it's not, in my opinion, it is not possible to, in 30 seconds, which is about how often you want to try to hit a laugh. It's not possible to explain FSH. It's not possible to explain the profound impact and like what it does to people. I have to make this approachable and accessible to the audience, which means I have to talk about it in a way that they understand. And obviously I need an economy of words. Like I need to say something and I need to get to my punch like as quick as I can. So once I had figured out like, okay, set aside when you're writing the joke, all I need to do is make sure that the beginning of the sentence is the truth. You know, it starts with I'm struggling because I'm getting weaker. That's all I need to say. That is the truth, you know? And then when I get into, you know, whatever the setup is, this is what I'm struggling with. And then this is why it's funny.
Nice.
Like, you know, whatever punchline that I've come up with for whatever joke. And that's the approach. And the reason that I chose comedy was because being disabled and muscular dystrophy and all stuff is inherently a depressing topic. but if you can find a way to make it relatable to people and make it approachable, then I think it can be done. That's just my opinion. And the analogy that I give in people is if you stand on the corner of a busy street, let's say it's New York, and as people are walking by, you say, can you help me cure cancer? The average person is just going to go like, no, that's way too big of a problem. Way too big of a problem. Like for anyone to solve. So they're going to disengage, right? They're going to be like, I'm sorry, I can't help you. Yeah, but absolutely. If you stand there and you have a picture and you're like, this is my dad and he's got cancer or he's got muscular dystrophy. And I've already looked into everything that you need to know about this. And can you give me like a dollar towards this cause? Then the problem becomes approachable for somebody. Yeah, I can help with that. Or maybe they still say no, and that's okay. That doesn't seem like directly related to comedy, but that's kind of the approach mentally that I took to writing these jokes. Was like, I can't go up here and tell you about all my problems, but I can tell you about one of them. And then I can try to find a way for it to be relatable, like to the average person.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Yeah.
That's kind of the angle that I've taken so far. Before COVID, I had been doing stand up for about a year. And then COVID hit, and you know, that sucks.
Right. Absolutely.
And so I was like, well, what can I do? Because every experienced comic that I talk to or work with says there's this number that you need to get to 10 years before you'll be really, really good at this.
Wow.
And I don't know that it's 10 years because I know comics around here that get work regularly. And that to me, that's enough. If I ever get good enough that I'm performing in a club for 20 minutes once a week, I'd be like, I would say I'm very successful. I'm good at this, like, good enough.
Yeah.
But maybe it doesn't take 10 years, but it still does take a lot of time. It is a process. It's just like climbing. You got to get in shape. You got to learn, you got to train your grip. You got to learn how to be more, you got to get more flexible. It's the same thing with stand up. And it was like I said earlier, you know, once you see the way broadly, you will know it in all things. Mm. You know, when I started doing stand up, I realized like it's incredibly hard to get stage time. There's a lot of competition, but you know, and I'm struggling with stage fright, just like everyone else. I was like, well, what can I do right now, since it's so hard to get behind a microphone? Like, how can I expose myself? How can I train? I looked at it as a rock climber.
Yeah.
Where's the gym? You know, when I was a rock climber, I could go train whenever I wanted for hours. As long as I had a partner there to train with me, I could go do whatever. But when you do stand up, I can't just go get behind a mic in front of a crowd. You got to start with open mics. You start with small shows. You start with that type of thing. And that's where I'm at. And I was like, well, what else can I do? So I started doing, I can't remember the name of it. There's a public club where you practice public speaking. Toastmasters. Mm. That's what it was. I started doing Toastmasters just because, and improv classes, which didn't make my stand up any better, like at all, because this is very physical stuff. I'm not a physical dude.
Yeah.
But I started doing these things because they made me uncomfortable and because I had to do them in front of other people. And I was like, you know, can I train this fear out? Basically was my approach, just like climbing. I was like, just spend more time in the wall, be able to manage this fear of heights. And I approached it the same way I did climbing. And that's kind of the story. So I started getting into it and then was like, well, I'm going to do Toastmasters because they make me stand in front of about 20 or 30 people, which is about what you run into in a club on a slow night. And, talk to them about whatever topic they asked me to do and just get comfortable in that space, you know? And that's the way that I started to do it. And then COVID hit and then I was like, okay, well, this looks like it's going to be a few months. Little did we know.
Yeah. Right.
What am I going to do? Because again, I was like, no one needs help right now. Like I can't stop just because this thing, but I also stages are closed. I literally can't do this right now. So what can I do? And, there's like nothing stopping me from doing a podcast.
Right.
Then I ask myself, why would I do a podcast if I'm not that good yet? And then I realized I was like, well, I don't need to be good if all I'm doing is hosting it.
Right.
Like I can get out of the way. Yeah. I can get out of the way. Yeah, yeah, totally. I can try to bring on people that, as comics that inspire me, and get out of the way and let them be the show, and also try to find a niche for something that, there's a million great stand up,
huge
million great comedy podcasts out there.
Yeah.
So I need something unique and I do want it to be related to, you know, not necessarily being disabled, but I do want to use it subtly as a platform to talk about this. And I started kind of observing the way that I watch podcasts is like, I don't know about you, but I have my favorites and I love, now it's the point where I don't just listen. I like watch the video version.
Okay. Yeah.
And I get hooked into who the people are, not just how funny they are, but like, you know, these comics talk about their lives and they give you updates on, and I get hooked. I'm like, oh, what happened with that thing? You know, and I want to know.
So you're watching their progress. Yeah.
Yeah. It's absolute silly stuff. Like it doesn't, it's not important at all. But I realized I was like, oh, like I'm a fan of this because the fact that they openly talk about their lives makes me feel like I have, this sounds crazy, but it makes me feel like I have this friend, like that, you know, I'm following their stuff and that's what they're going for. Like they're trying to make the audience feel like a fly on the wall in a lot of these comedy podcasts. And I was like, well, okay. So if you can turn a stranger into a friend, you can turn them into an advocate. Like you can turn them into somebody that cares about muscular dystrophy. So then I was like, okay, well, I'll start a podcast and there's going to, I want it to not just be a funny podcast. I want it to be about the experience of doing stand-up. What is it like for the people that are failing? What is it like for the people going back to rock climbing? What is it like for the people that are falling off the wall? Because people talk to me about winning nationals. Nobody ever asked me what happened on Tuesday when I wasn't doing well before, like, and all of the other countless days before it.
Yeah.
And also like, as you get in, as you start doing stand-up, you get to know their comics and you get to see that they're inherently interesting people because they've trained themselves to talk about their lives openly in a way that most people don't. And that is fascinating to me. Like I love the fact, like if you listen to my podcast, there's somebody who gets on there. I don't know if I'm not going to get into it actually on here, but it's like the second episode and he openly talks about some stuff. And I was like, my jaw's on the floor, you know, when he's talking about, and I was like, yeah. Dude, we're give me a second there to turn on the microphones. And this was someone that I had met like 5 minutes before. He's talking about like this girl that he's seeing. I'll say, please listen to it. It's the episode with Amos Mack. You'll know what I'm talking about. But that was fascinating to me. And I was like, well, if I do a podcast, then like all I need to do is figure out the audio video. All I need to do is, I made it sound easy, like a dummy. I had no idea what you and I are now doing, like what goes into it. I was like, I can figure that out.
Yes. It's a pain.
Yeah. But I was like, I can get out of the way and let the audience get to know me as the host and get to know all these different personalities. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to put FSH in their face. I'm not going to like create a show where I'm like, this sucks. And I want to, that's not what I'm going to do.
Right.
I'm going to let them get to know these personalities and slowly over time, I'm going to let them get to know me, which is scarier than it sounds. And they might one day, if I'm 100 episodes in, if I say like, hey guys, I'm doing a thing, can you donate $5, you know, and make sure that they have the ability to donate right off of their phone, directly through their apps that they're using, Cash App, Venmo, PayPal. That's right. What everybody uses. Make it easy for somebody to help and give them a reason to care about it. And they probably will help.
Absolutely.
And that's the approach. And so that's why I use comedy. It's because it's a way, I do love it. Even if I wasn't disabled, I would still probably be doing it. Like just because it is, when you do well, it is amazing. Like when you do horrible, it's horrible. But
the highs are highs and lows, like, are lows.
Yes. Yeah, totally. And I was like, this is what I can do. And this is what I can do right now while the stages are closed. I can let other people get to know these personalities of these people. I can tell their story. And every now and again, when they ask me why I'm doing it, I will be honest and answer their questions, but I'm going to try to get out of the way.
Right.
And just let the audience get to know me as the host who's providing this to them. And if they care to reach out and be a part of asking these questions and learning, then I'm going to share.
Right.
But I'm not going to, my approach for this was, I'll let you discover it and you tell me if you care. I'm not going to try to get 1,000 people to care. I'm going to put something out there. And if one person tells me that they care, then that's great. That's, you know, 1 out of 1,000 is to me very successful.
Absolutely. Well,
so that's the approach.
Man, Carlos, you have had quite the journey that you've shared with us, and including the journey on this show where we've lost you and we got you back. And I'm glad you came back because it's been amazing. If to finish up, if anybody wants to find more about you, your podcast, all those great things that you're doing, how can they do that?
If they go to thecrappycomics.com, you'll find all the links that you need. This stuff is still relatively early in development. Like, I'm still standing up the infrastructure. We just put up the new website. Mm-hmm. And, you know, personally, I'm not a big social media person, so I just started the accounts for that. And we're going to be releasing some like short clips, and I've got projects in the works with other comics that I'm really, really excited about. And I'm starting to work on very short form comedy stuff. Nice. For like TikTok and like 1 minute clips, stuff like that, to increase traffic to the podcast. Smart. But if you go to thecrappycomics.com, there's links to everything, including there's the podcast. And then I also do a comedy board gaming live stream. If you're geeky and you're into that stuff, we've raised over $1,000 in the last 3 or 4 months through doing board gaming stuff, which sounds weird. A lot of people don't know that board games, like a modern board gaming, exists.
Yeah.
But if you're a homebody and you like doing simple math, then check out modern board games. But I do a comedy show where it's me and another comic, and we play games and we review them, and we promote it as, this is a show for adults. We say whatever we want on here, and we've managed to do raffles and all kinds of stuff.
Wow.
Related to gaming that has been really successful. So, but Crappy Comics Podcast is the podcast, got nothing to do with games. And then Crappy Comics Play Games is this emerging thing that I do with a guy named Kyle Riley, who's another 1 year comic like me.
Awesome.
And that's been really successful. And actually through that, we're starting to make connections with people that also do charitable events in the same space, like where you would never expect to find it. But you won't find it unless you put it out there and you get an idea and you just pursue it and see where it goes. And so that's what I'm doing. I'm just trying to lean into, I have an idea and I'm going to trust that it works. There's going to be some growing pains. I'm going to embarrass myself, but I'm still going to stick to it. And that's kind of like the whole story, I guess.
And it's been an awesome one, man. You've been phenomenal to have on. We're gonna have to have you on again, and then I'm probably gonna bother you to be like on our telethon event where I'm like on and I do this for like 14 straight hours. We got to slot you in for that, man. There's more stuff to come, I think, for you. You're a great guest, great person to have on. Really enjoyed the conversation.
I'm game. Yeah. Thanks for having me. And I'm a big fan of the society and everything that they do, including the radio show. And, thank you for what you're doing and for having me on. This is such a great opportunity. So
absolutely. Yeah. Take care. Take care, Carlos. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, you too. Take care and stay safe out there.
Wow. Carlos, man, what a story, man. That was awesome. That was awesome. I know, guys, that we went a little over, and that's okay. And I'll tell you why, because it's like, because it just, things had to be said, right? We had to have him on, and we had to do the full history of Carlos here, because he's done so many great things, and really love to have him on. So before I let you guys go, I wanted to kind of close up shop here a little bit and tell you what's going on with the FSHD Society when it comes to events. And let's play a little bit of our close music here. Thanks, Astro, for being here. And don't forget, check out all these events and other things at fshdsociety.org. March 13th, we have the Colorado chapter meeting. March 16th is the San Diego chapter meeting. These are all virtual, of course, still. And then March 18th is the FSHD University webinar, where they're going to talk about managing difficult emotions and experiences with Dr. David Younger. That looks like a good event. Got to be a part of that. And then March 30th, the Caregiver Sharegiver Hour. And that's a nice little side segue into Sue Drescher, who is on our show last month. And she's the one that heads up the Caregiver Sharegiver Hour. So thank you all for being here, hanging tight with us tonight. I know we went long, but I don't care, because it was a great conversation. And Carlos is an amazing person, and I'm glad that he spent some time with us throughout any little glitches. It happens. And you know what? I'm glad that he spent the time, the extra time with us today. and I thank you for doing the same. So want to reach out to me? Don't forget, you can email me, fshdradio@fshdsociety.org. We'll see you next month. And I think our guest is going to be, if I take a look at this, Jamshid Arjamand, right? That's right, of the FSHD Society. He will be our guest next month. So we'll see you back here second week of the second Tuesday of April. Wow, it'll be April already. Take care. Be safe out there. You've been listening to the FSHD Society Radio Show.